The Global Sport Matters podcast is presented by Morgan Stanley Global Sports and Entertainment, a division of Morgan Stanley Wealth Management dedicated to serving the unique and sophisticated needs of professional athletes and entertainers. This is Sport Matters with Kenneth Shropshire and Bill Roden. From academia to media, Ken and Bill explore the edges of sport, unpacking race and culture beyond the game.
All right. Welcome to the Sport Matters podcast. I'm Ken Shropshire, and I'm here with my good friend, Bill Roden. So, hey, Bill, how's it going? You're back in Arizona with us.
Yes, it was always great, man. Leaving New York in the snow and landing in Arizona, albeit amid a pandemic, but it's all good.
Hey, it's what they say, it's the new normal. We got to keep moving around here. It's going to move cautiously.
Yeah, that's what they say. You know, they say, I was listening to people rationalizing being out and about, say, hey, you know, you just have to. I think it was somebody I was listening to. The mayor of Atlanta. The mayor of Atlanta is saying how they're going to go on with the Martin Luther King parade down in Atlanta. And I'm like, you know, it was a Houston mayor, a brother. And they're saying, you know, the reporter was trying to be polite. He said, well, are you still doing the Martin Luther King Day parade? He said, oh, yes, yes. And then there was a silence. I know she wanted to ask, are you nuts? And so she finally asked, well, you know, amid the breakouts of corona, are there any concerns? And then he said, relative to your point, yeah, well, you know, we just have to adjust to the new normal. We have to move forward, you know. So I guess that's the mindset of people in power, money people, that some kind of way, we can't hide in our silos because we got to make money and we got to keep things rolling. So,
it remains difficult, but we try not to make this the corona show. Although for the past 2 years, that's been the lead for everything. We got a lot of big stuff to talk about. So, Brian Flores and all the elements of that. You know, the college football championship happened last night as we're recording. We want to touch on Antonio Brown and Novak Djokovic and all the issues related to those two. And you'll see the commonalities that we see in those two people. For our movie review, King Richard, our new segment, movie review, and soon to come is a book review. Just a little teaser, John Feinstein's book on race and sports. We'll get to that another day. And, you know, and then we want to do some, you know, kind of continue our movie thing. We do want to talk for a moment about Sidney Poitier and then do some predictions on what we see coming forward, kind of spirit of the new year to talk in that kind of way. So Bill, I to me at least, I don't know if you disagree. The big story is the firing of Brian Flores by the Miami Dolphins. And, you know, I'll tee it up, and I really want to hear your thoughts on it. We haven't had a chance to talk about this at length other than exchanging a couple of texts, basically saying, right. What? What's right. Going, what's going right. on here?
Right.
I mean, we have, I guess in the most positive way, sometimes referred to Miami as Wakanda, that they – you know, black GM, black head coach, black head of PR, black general counsel. So they've been ahead of the game, although, you know, and no need to get too deep into it right now, but, you know, the owner, Stephen Ross, who starts the great foundation, RISE, Ross Initiative in Sports for Equality, he certainly has some, you know, political issues that don't mesh with the public reflection of the franchise. You know, Flores had been, he's been there 3 years, first year in losing season. The past two, some degree of success, especially this year in some ways, even more so, where he found a way to make things work and was on the road to greater success, but didn't make the playoffs. So he gets fired. What are you making of this? I mean, it's not, you know, Some coaches need to be fired, but this wasn't one. This is kind of one of those rare moments where you said, no, wait a minute, I thought his record was okay.
Yeah. all the things you mentioned, you know, that's funny about the Dolphins as Wakanda with all the black folks. You know, but on the other hand, and I was thinking about this, I was surprised by Flores. But then I always think, you know, people like Ross always give themselves cover. You know, so when you do have a lot of black folks, you know, and it could be the same thing with women or any other target minority, when you have a lot, then you could fire somebody, you know, and say, well, you know, no, I'm not racist. I mean, I've got, what do you mean? Chris Greer is the general manager, you know, or we've got a black this, or we got a black that. So, of course, I'm not racist. So you always give yourself cover. And I don't know, I did hear, you know, they kept Greer, or Greer kept himself, you know, and fired. And somebody said that, you know, that Flores wanted to change the staff and that maybe people were not thrilled about who he was going to change the staff to. But, you know, he did, there was all the drama about, you know, who wanted to get Watson, you know, Deshaun Watson. And Flores was put in a tough position because he always had to say, no, our guy is Tua. Our guy is Tua. Even at the height of those Deshaun Watson rumors, trade rumors. And the fact that, you know, the defense was terrible early on, and that was supposed to be his calling card, was defense. And also, then now the intriguing thing becomes, you know, Harbaugh, the rumors that John Harbaugh wants to leave Michigan and wants to come into the NFL. And,
well, Jim Harbaugh.
I mean, I'm sorry, Jim Harbaugh, but John Harbaugh might want to go too.
You know? Leave Baltimore to go to Miami. Why not?
Yeah, you know, maybe they could coach together. But Jim Harbaugh, the rumor is that he wants to leave Michigan. And somebody was saying that, you know, in Michigan, they've got a building named after Ross. I think a business building.
There may be a building. The whole business school is the Ross School of Business. So he gave a ton of money for that. And he's a regular, you know, regular donor there on a regular basis. So, yeah, there's a great connection there. When I was working with him years ago, I mean, when they were hiring a new athletic director, like, he was deeply entrenched and involved in this. And, you know, the jet goes to Ann Arbor and Miami on the weekends. I mean, he's going to games everywhere. So he's, you know, fully engaged with that institution like he is with the Dolphins. I've been reading Feinstein's book, and he talks about black coaches getting fired, and he, of course, highlights Lovie Smith, who got fired after going 10-6. Mm-hmm. And then he says, you know, the list of people with successful records that got fired is actually pretty short. You know, Lovie, Schottenheimer, that year he got fired in San Diego, 14-2 in 2006. And then Dungy, of course, you know, fired at 9-7, and then hands the team over to the great Mr. Gruden, John Gruden. Right. But otherwise, you know, it's not something that happens a lot that somebody with a winning record and you know, I don't know, I'm not a football historian. I don't think anybody with a run like he had at the end has ever been fired. Somebody with this really on the upswing. So yeah, there's a, you know, the element that we won't read in Sports Illustrated or Sporting News or see on ESPN, or maybe we will, maybe a couple of them on Fox, is the idea, you know, I mentioned Wakanda, is this black on black crime. I mean, right. The idea that you have, you know, part of the fantasy that I know you and I have written about in different ways is how there'd be a higher level of fairness. The black ownership is one thing. So we, you know, that, you know, and we saw with Bob Johnson and the Bobcats, who kind of got a moment to see that. But here it is, you know, you have a black person who's making fire decisions, and he fires another black person under mysterious circumstances. So the first thing out of the box, maybe it was from you, I don't know, isn't race. It's like, what's going on? Where, you know, been the, You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know if I'm reaching a little bit, but is there something unique about this, because it is the Wakanda setting, that we got to step back and say, this is just crazy football stuff?
Well, it's that, but I also think, because, you know, obviously I don't know the dynamics. I know I did text you.
No.
And said you need to re-resign again. it clearly comes from the owner. You know, I mean, I don't know if Chris Greer wakes up, independently says, I'm going to fire Brian Flores. I don't know what their relationship is, and again, I work with a lot of black publications. I went to a black school. And one of the things that does do you is that, we come in all shapes and sizes and flavors. It's not like we're all in this group and we're all marching lockstep, that right. There's all shades. As Adam Clayton Powell said, we're from shark to charcoal, we run the whole gamut of things intellectually. So, and the great thing about having a critical mass, when you only have one or two black folks in a room, we're all carrying the shield, But when you have a critical mass, like 15, then we're all free to kind of, be ourselves and have our individual differences, knowing that if I go against you, that's not going to, wreck the race, I don't know if Miami, they got to that kind of critical mass where Greer could look around and say, there's enough black presence here that if I think we need to make a change, I'll make a change. But even with that, we don't know if Harbaugh becomes a head coach at Miami, then then it's kind of clear that they wanted to fire Flores to make room for another white guy. I think what you were saying is that we got to a point, and I don't think we have, where remember back in the day, you'd hire a black guy, so we know we've made it when you could also fire the black guy, when the black guy gets fired.
Right.
I don't know if we're there yet, but it is baffling. Then the next question, of course, is how quickly will he get another job? Or will he go through like Moses in the wilderness and have to spend another decade?
I haven't looked at and heard about his contract. I assume there's some time left. So, it's a very unique situation to be able to sit out for a year and get paid, something like that. So he might just choose to do that for the old, Dick Vermeil burnout kind of thing, to feel better about stuff. The one thing you mentioned, Adam Clayton Powell, which reminded me of, so we're noting great black people who talked about relationships amongst black people. Remember when Thurgood Marshall was stepping down from the Supreme Court. And it kind of, interesting to think about that. He steps down and trying to make room for, another black person to be on the court, et cetera. And they ask him I think the question was, does the next justice replace you have to be black? And he said something like, well, it doesn't matter if it's a black snake or a white snake, it's a snake. I mean, he was very much along the lines you're saying, that you got to evaluate the person, and the race itself is not gonna make this person someone who is the kind of thinker you want in these kinds of positions, the kind of leader that you want in these positions. So neither one of us knows Chris Greer, in that kind of way to know what's going on there. He's been, the other thing about him is he's a long timer. He's been with the organization, I don't know, 12, 15 years.
His father was in the business, I think.
Yeah, it's a long, so it was very different. Flores, in some sense, is the outsider in the whole operation. So there's that too. But that's one to look at. And let's in our predictions, I do have a thought about where Flores might end up with the proviso of if he can sit back and get paid off the contract, you might see him on CBS doing a little commentary.
That's another thing, Ken. You bring up a good point in that, I guess I've been thinking more about this too, about even the racism in the press box, you know, in the broadcast booth, you know, who makes the jump from the field, you know, because when you say Flores, will he go to the broadcast booth? And I'm thinking, although you do have, Dungy, and you used to have Harrison, that also, there seems to be a regression there as well, because when you said, you know, Flores going to the broadcast booth, I said, man, that would be very uncommon, unusual for him to go. I think it would be, you know, it would be great. And I think the other question, I don't know how you feel about this. I think another part of this discussion is that I'm not sure, and we've talked about this before in personal and in public and private meetings, is the role of Black players in the NFL, active Black players, to raise their voices in consternation about, we go through this every single year, you know, and every single year we talk about, well, the league is 69-70% Black players, but that does not really matter if that 70% of Black players keeps their mouth shut, you know, and they don't say anything about an issue that ultimately is going to affect them. You know, I'm looking at the San Francisco, all these great games over the weekend, San Francisco and L.A. and Oakland and San Diego. And I'm thinking all these brothers running up and down, and, you know, the white juniors coaches, you know, Shanahan, whose father coached, the guy from L.A., you know, the young genius.
Yeah, Brandon Staley, yeah.
Yeah, how many of these Black guys who are running and jumping and making all these great plays, in 15 years, how many of them are going to be head coaches? You know, how many of them are going to be in this pipeline that we talk about? So I think that's another thing we could talk about, the, as we do every year, the lack of hiring. But at what point, you know, will this Black critical mass kind of rise up and say, listen, man, enough is enough. And I know this gets back to D'Amore Smith. Some kind of way it always gets back to D'Amore Smith, you know, the head of the Players Association, who says, that ain't my job, is to rally the troops about social justice issues. So anyway, that's what I'm thinking. We could talk about the firing and all the great Black candidates, but at what point, and I don't know whether you agree with this or not, but do the players, Aaron Donald, all these great players in the league, you know, do they have an obligation to let their voices be heard, or do you kind of get co-opted by the money and say, listen, my job is just to play football, and, you know, I'm not here to read, you know. We saw what happened to Kaepernick, so that's not my job. I don't know how you feel about whether they've got that role or not.
Yeah, no, you raise a great point, and you probably raise it with more.
What does John feel? That's the more important thing. What does he think?
You raise it with more optimism and more consistently than probably anybody else in terms of the players need to step up. And, you know, $40 million slave is kind of underlying theme within that is this is where the power is. And, you know, I think you and I talked about it. The one moment where we've seen that recently, we think, is with the Notre Dame coach, Dame head coach, and the players rallied around and kind of shortcut and stuff, said, no, we got the guy right here. And, you know, probably he was interim, and they said, no, we want him to be the full-time coach. So it is interesting to think about with Flores, if they're, you know, a player's coach, if they loved him in a way that, it's stated in some places that they did, but there's just not a, you know, Kenny Stills was there. If Kenny Stills was still there, would Kenny, for example, you know, player who's, you know, still kneeling, would he be somebody that would step up and kind of leave some kind of movement to say, no, you can't fire this guy? I don't know how, you know, as you said, it's you're sort of saying at the same time, I don't want to play anymore if you're going to step up.
Yeah, it's career suicide. I'm ready not to play anymore.
but I want to do what's right. So yeah, the idea of, and part of what this ties into is we're getting ready to, and, you know, Black Monday, kind of the inappropriately named.
Do we get rid of that? What about starting with that? You know, what about starting with Black Monday?
How about not so Black Monday in terms of hiring? So now we are where we have Tomlin and Culley. So Mike Tomlin and Dave Culley at Houston. You know, Tomlin's he's in the play. Tomlin's fine.
He's emeritus.
Yeah, Culley is probably on the cusp, although nobody expected anything positive to happen down there. He did okay.
He almost seemed to be. That's a very interesting thing. I mean, now, Tomlin represents a whole other end of the spectrum. You know, a brother who been there for, 15 years or something? I mean, you know, Mike Tomlin represents the entire opposite spectrum of what we're talking about. Culley, to me, is a compelling case because, in a way, he seemed to have been put there to take care of Deshaun Watson, you know?
Yeah.
And Watson was like, hell no. Remember, this is before all hell broke loose, you know, when Deshaun was taking a really principled stand about, I don't want to play for this organization. You know, they didn't include me in the hiring decision, blah, blah, blah. Then all of a sudden, as we know, all 5,000 women came, materialized.
Cases emerged, Cases, which is a whole nother.
That's another segment.
It's all serious and all this, but yeah, another conspiracy theory. But the timing was just so ironic. Yeah, and Culley, it's almost like, some of those, you know, great old blaxploitation movies where Putney Swope, for example, where, you know, we didn't expect him to come in, you know, Putney Swope to the black
Putney
guy.
Putney Swope, right.
and great old kind of tale where nobody wants anybody else to be the CEO of a company. So they all say, well, let's vote for the black guy. Putney Swope becomes the CEO of this company. All this crazy stuff happens. Well, in some ways, Culley was the last man standing. And they did, you know, frankly, I don't think they expected much success out of him. And he had, you know, nothing fantastic, but modest success was on his way. So he's just, you know, in some ways they thought he was going to be disposable, but it's not the case. That it was an 0 for season, 0 for 17, 18 season, however many games we got, losing track. So it's going to be interesting to watch this whole process. And so, you know, we'll get some predictions in a moment and some last thoughts on that. But I do want to, you know, talk about just a couple other things. Antonio Brown, we didn't convene as he walked off the field, took his shirt off and walked off the field. And, you know, so on the one hand, it is this dramatic, you know, kind of defiant kind of rule, norm breaking kind of moment for a player to walk off the field in that kind of way. And for the Bruce Arians head coach to say he's no longer a Buck, kind of immediately in the afterwards. but you know, it is interesting. Think there are two elements of it. Again, he's got a whole history, so I would not want to take the case. But if I was going to make the case, I would say, and he says it's not. But, you know, I think for actions speak louder than the commentary on where you think you are in mental health. And number two, there seems that there was actually a physical injury. There's some kind of ankle injury. Now, again, I'm not in the training room. I don't know how factual it is. And it seems the exchange was, I don't want to go in because of my injury. Now, if you can, if you put another player in that place, somebody without the history, maybe without the same, in honor of Brad Pye Jr., without the same paint job, could we see that just as a convergence of this mental health injury and you know, I just can't take it, and we would have some level of sympathy for him? How's that case, Bill?
Yeah, no, I like that because I think that the thing is, the problem is we convict him for everything he's done. In other words, like you said, you wouldn't take the cape. You know, I remember when he threw his furniture off the balcony, you know, and for some reason that always stands out. That was my first, you know, when he threw the furniture off the balcony, you know, for something. And then he was, you know, clock going 150 miles an hour on the, you know, all these kinds of things. And
he's not a desirable client.
But just because he did that doesn't make him wrong in this instance, you know. And I've been listening to this stuff, and on the spot, you know, he could be one of these brothers. It doesn't matter whether it's sustained for 80,000 people or whatever. When he reaches the breaking point, then F you, I'm out of here. And a guy like, and he knew, you know, he knew Arians didn't want him there to begin it. He knew he was there because of Brady. So who knows how much of this stuff was building up, you know. They bring him back whenever they need him. Remember, they weren't going to use him, and all of a sudden all the wide receivers got hurt. One guy tore his ACL. Somebody else got hurt. They needed Antonio Brown. But when you know somebody is only tolerating you, and then, you know, a guy like Arian, to his own, in his own words, turned around and said, "You're through. Get the F out of here." Now, you know, there's certain people you just don't say that to. You know, particularly this white guy saying that to a guy like Brown, then he takes all the stuff, said, "All right, I'm getting F out of here." And it's bizarre. You know, right there, I'm out of here. Takes all the stuff out. And you know, we've all played football, and we've been on these teams where there are certain things you just don't do, particularly the conservative NFL. Remember a guy like Dwayne Thomas? Remember, yeah. When you got those kinds of people, you know, who are kind of outside the box, you know, play like football, they don't tolerate outside the box behavior, particularly when you're a brother. So you're absolutely right. If this was his first quote unquote offense, you know, if he was like Derek Jeter or like, you know, Russell Wilson, name all the other black acceptable blacks, you know, who white people like, you know, Sidney Poitier. We'll get to that later. But all the, you know, there's a list, you know, of acceptable blacks. You know, if it was one of the acceptable blacks who had done that, you know, they're like, well, I don't know, you know, maybe, I don't know, you know, Julius normally doesn't act like this, you know, something like that. But because it's Antonio, it's dismissed. But he may have had a point. He may have actually had a point that you told me to get the F out of here, so I'm getting the F out of here. And here's your equipment, here's your pick, here's your shovel, here's your bushel of cotton, you know, I'm out of here, you know. So I don't know that I was.
Yeah, so I don't know, you know, if we talk about Flores, you know, who might pick him up or where might he go? You know, that's a real discussion, I think. But you know, I don't know if it's impossible with Antonio Brown. I you know, because it's not, you know, it's not a you think about that. It's not a Kaepernick moment in that sense. I mean, it is the defiance of the norm and all that sort of thing. But the guy can play. You know, the guy can play. If somebody needs him, Is there a possibility we could see him again? And you know, when standard used to be, would the Raiders take him? Right.
Back in the day, if Al Davis was there, he'd be there. Yeah. Well, he may have never left. You know.
Yeah. If Warren Wells can come out the joint and come be a wide receiver.
Warren Wells. Oh, man.
Anybody can play.
That's a great name, at Warren Wells.
Yeah. Young folks, Google that one.
Warren Wells. Oh, man. Yeah. I'd be surprised, though. You know, and I guess, you know, all of us have to ask, I run a sports and recreation program at a church, and you're dealing with young people. You know, we have like a little basketball program. You're dealing with temper tantrums and things like that. And I'd ask myself, if Antonio Brown was in my program, you know, would I throw him out the gym? And you probably have to tell you that, yeah, I'd probably have to throw him out the gym. Though there were instances, one of my coaches, there was a kid who threw a tip fit and left, and I wanted to throw him out. And the coach came up to me and said, "Bill, that's one of my best players." And we're talking about like a 12-year-old. And the gentleman said, that's exactly the problem, you know, because he was so hurt. I said, out the jail. But the kid was crying. And so, you know, the drama that Bill came up to me, he said, yeah, Bill, that's one of my best players. I said, oh, my God. You know, on a Saturday afternoon in Harlem with a 12-year-old and the game means nothing, he said, man, you can't throw this kid out because he's one of my best. So we're not even talking about an Antonio Brown type of person, you know. So I don't know.
Well, then, and the other problem, then we'll move on to Djokovic, was you always reminded me of stuff from my youth. In high school, we had this guy on the team, James Miller. He passed away now, so I can use his name. And he was involved in gang activity. And the coach said, you know, no gang stuff or you're off the team. So he threw him off the team. Not only did he throw off the team, he got thrown out of school. And I'm telling you, it was 2 weeks later, we played, Emmanuel Arts was the school, you know, and I go out with the captains to shake hands, and the captain from Emmanuel Arts is James Miller. He ended up out of school. So the moral of the story is, be sure you really want to get rid of somebody, because you might see him again. And again, with Brown and Flores, I think that's part of what the concern has to be. But, you know, the James Miller rule, you may see, and he went on, he was all city, all this and that. Just a fantastic athlete who ended up in Soledad. But that's another story for another day.
This episode of the Global Sport Matters podcast is brought to you by Morgan Stanley Global Sports and Entertainment. You have that something extra, the star quality, the intangibles that put you on top of your game, your artistry. You flourish in fiercely competitive industries. You already have the vision, but you may need the plan. Your distinct needs inspired the creation of Morgan Stanley Global Sports and Entertainment, a division of Morgan Stanley Wealth Management dedicated to serving the unique and sophisticated needs of professional athletes and entertainers. We speak your language, we understand your business, and can help you achieve your goals. Visit ms.com/GSE to learn more.
So, you know, the Antonio Brown, the other piece of it was the fake vaccination card that he had, which connects us up with Novak Djokovic trying to get in as we speak today to the Australian Open. I guess he's sitting in a not too wonderful hotel in Australia where they're holding people that are trying to get their visa straight and that sort of thing. But it has been hearings and the like about whether or not he was had permission to come in to the country. And I guess Novak is a big guess. I mean, he is a big anti-vaxxer. I'm not going to do this. And I don't know what are we seeing, you know, and I guess we should throw in for good measure Aaron Rodgers to kind of think about this whole space. You know, Kyrie, I guess that's kind of passe now. Maybe we've gotten past that.
We have an all-star team. The anti-vaxxer all-star team. Aaron Rodgers, Kyrie, and now Djokovic. So we have a tennis player, a football player, and a quarterback on the anti-vax, the all-anti-vax team.
but what should happen in Australia? I mean, part of it too is what do you call it? Exceptionalism, the idea of making these exceptions for athletes. Yeah. What do you think, you know, start leaning into predictions. What's going to happen down there, and what should happen?
That is part of my prediction. Maybe we'll have this discussion without me making the prediction. Maybe.
Okay.
But I think, you know, there's Novak Djokovic right now in Asia. But, you know, as we were talking about this, his biggest punishment was the Australians put him at the Days Inn with all these other people. You know, put you at the Days Inn. You know? Oh, no. Okay. Shoot me up now. We'll put your tall ass at the day, Motel 6. We'll put you at Motel 6. I guess that kills our sponsorship, right? We won't get those sponsors.
He's never stayed anywhere less than the Four Seasons.
Right.
They skipped about 18 different rungs and right. put him straight
with all the these other people. He's going to put him there with all these other people, like itinerants and all that, at Motel 6. We're going to make you stay there. and then we're going to make you give tennis lessons, free tennis lessons. And if you do that, you can come in.
In the courtyard with the free breakfast where they got the frozen waffles.
Get a free breakfast. Oh, man. And then now we'll let you play and you'll lose in the first round. But, you know, one thing I was thinking is we should be writing all this stuff, man. This is like, you couldn't make this stuff up. But the one thing I was thinking this morning when I was listening to the latest is this is, again, you know, I think clearly what's happening in the United States is that money has become the highest value. When you look at the NFL finishing this season, all these things, you know, clearly it's money over health, you know, when they have full arenas and all that. And I'm just wondering, when it comes to Australia, where Djokovic is the number one seed, he's a big draw, will money become the highest value? You say, listen, we cannot not have this guy compete, or will they do the ethical thing and say, no, man, you know, you lie on this, on your visa application, and, you know, you cannot play. So I think that's, to me, that's what it boils down to. Will they allow money to rule, or will they take an ethical stand and say that if you're a non-vaxxer and you lied about it, then you're just not going to play? We don't care who you are.
You know, in your the equation you're putting out there, it also fits with the change from 10 days quarantine to 5, and how the sports leagues immediately embraced that and said, great, we won't have to shut games down. And, you know, just in case anybody doesn't have their calendar in front of them, that there's almost no day you can get ill early in the week that doesn't allow you to play on Sunday. So it gives you that much more leeway, and that. You know, it could be health. I don't know, the whole idea of keeping the economy going, all those sorts of things. You know, does that outweigh the health factor, or is it more about money keeping things rolling and otherwise? And I think, yeah, whether or not Novak gets to play down in Australia, I think money is going to come into play on that. Now, and I look forward to your prediction. But to move into our movie segment, and it also starts with a tennis segment, it's still playing. And you and I talked about it as it first came on. But the Will Smith, King Richard presentation, focused on Richard Williams and the raising of Venus and Serena. And I think you said you watched it and were entertained. I mean, maybe watching it for entertainment value. I was watching it to see how many of our friends were depicted. African American financial manager, a great lawyer who's passed, who worked with him early on. Kevin Davis, who's just a great mutual friend who we miss dearly. And, you know, I didn't watch it with a fine tooth comb, but I don't remember either of them being mentioned. I haven't talked to, the financial manager and also
Larry Bailey.
The marketing guy, because the story turned out to be, more of a white savior story than what I thought Richard was all about. And that was a lot of Black empowerment, a lot of focus on using African-American professionals to be successful. But in fact, the way the story was laid out, that's not what happened. Now again, maybe I had an incorrect view of how the whole thing transpired. And I didn't really understand what was going on there. Carlos Fleming is the other guy, you know, who's had some deep involvement now. I guess he was a little bit later on. This was more in the early moments, but both Kevin Davis and Larry Daly were in there early on.
Yeah, you saw that. I was kind of going back and forth. I know I was watching with a group of people, and my colleague at the Undefeated, Soraya McDonald, actually killed it. You know, she killed the film because she thought that he was portrayed as such a country bumpkin and all that. And, you know, we both know Richard pretty well for me from a journalist standpoint. And he's a very sharp guy and very pro-black, you know. And you're right, he's very much into black empowerment, you know. And I'm not sure how much that came through. But then you mentioned it, you're absolutely right, that Kevin Davis, you know, man, you know, the great Kevin Davis, was really influential. I mean, I remember him flying to L.A., you know, and he believed in them. Kevin believed in them. And Larry Bailey, financial guy, really believed in them. And they were there at the ground floor giving him advice. You recall at his funeral, Venus relied so heavily on Kevin that one of the last things she said in her remarks was, you know, who am I going to call? You know, if I can't pick up the phone, call Kevin. I remember we all did it, man. I called Kevin for stuff, man, in the hotel when I shouldn't even say that, but I'll let that go.
And the most difficult of times.
At 1 in the morning, say, Kevin. You know, and he did that. So I think you're absolutely 100% right. That was missing. On the other hand, I guess the girls signed off on it, or else it wouldn't have seen the light of day. They thought that it was.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I saw them at the premiere, and that shows up again. I mean, what do I know? So, but that was just, you know, my Siskel and Ebert, just kind of my review of it was to wonder about. But you know, we talked about, I think last week we started kind of using the whole theme of revisionist history and how the stories get told and who tells the stories matters. And, you know, you talk a lot about, you know, black journalists and, you know, others talk a lot about, even in sports, these commentators that come on, the absence of, you know, plenty of former black athletes, but the absence of black journalists, people that are trained as journalists, in kind of some of these high flying positions where, you know, where the stories could be told by someone that is this professionally trained journalist as opposed to former ball player. Nothing wrong with it. But you go to the other side and you look at the white people in talent and otherwise, you didn't have to be a former athlete to get the chair, to be the person talking about this sort of stuff. So this story being told, again, I don't know who put it together. I don't know what made it more dramatic. I don't, you know, all those things are way, way out of my lane. And again, maybe it's just something personal, especially with regard to hell with Larry Bailey. but with regard to Kevin, the idea of his ass, you know, and again, it may even be, you know, he could have said, I never want the story to be told. I mean, we just don't know, and I haven't followed up. And that would be, by the way, something that he would do.
And again, you figure as much as he meant to Venus, maybe Venus didn't bring it up, or maybe, you know, we don't know all the dynamics. All we know is that it wasn't there. And, you know, sometimes there's such a thing as knowing a story too well.
I mean, it's, you know, it was highlighted that just a little bit more before we move on to, you know, Sidney Poitier and the predictions. But it is, you know, I talked about the John Feinstein book that I'm reading now, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee. You know, our friend Dave Zirin, another white guy, is writing quite a bit over the years and talking quite a bit over the years. There was a book, one of the earlier books that was kind of written trying to look at the topic by a guy named Phil Hoos, Hoose, called Necessities, came out right after the Al Campanis incident. And it is a different level of attention that comes to a book. And part of the, you know, Feinstein kind of intro is Doug Williams talks about the impact that a white person talking about this can have. So it is kind of, you know, it's an issue. It's something to, and again, we should spend more time thinking about it. You know, maybe get, you know, Siren on and talk to him.
You know, your friend, by the way, not mine. you can edit that out.
I'm gonna leave it at that. But it is, you know, who should tell the story? Are the stories being told correctly? And the King Richard story is one that I'm just pausing on to reflect on are some things missing and why. So dignity. That's what I think about with Sidney Poitier. I mean, this is a, you know, I didn't try to strain to figure out a sports connection on this. This is more our culture moment here to talk about Sidney. And I'm sure you, you know, I crossed paths when didn't know him at all in LA. I'm sure you did in New York over the years. Just as this, you know, on the screen as a kid, just such a unique presence, and it did, you know, the idea of, you know, black man suit and tie. I mean, it was always, you know, take Lilies of the Field out of there, but just always that presence that you said, boy, this guy's not taking, especially, you know, in the later years, and stuff like, you know, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and in the Heat of the Night, it was like not a superhero kind of, if you say Wakanda kind of. But this, you know, you're going to treat me with respect and dignity and watch the way that I move around. I don't know what your, you know, I'm sure you're saddened like everybody else, but any particular reaction to
Sidney? Yeah, all right. Yeah, I mean, in fact, he's, you know, 94. I was, you know, my dad passed when he was 94. I just found out that my former mother-in-law just passed away at 94. And you just think about that generation of black folks and all the stuff that they had to endure, you know, just whatever they were going to be, whether it be teaching or acting or just all the level of abuse and humiliation, all the stuff it took to get to a point that Sidney got to being a star, all the stuff. And remember, the whole thing about him was that in acting, black folks had been relegated to such menial roles, humiliating roles. The big thing about him was that, you're right, you know, the dignified black person. And one of the things that I remember John Thompson used to always say, that when people say he was the first to do this, they try to make it feel like it's our fault as black folks, you know, that we're the first. And John said, no, man, there were hundreds and thousands of black folks who were qualified. And that's on you, meaning on the white establishment, it's on you. Don't put it on me that I was the first to actually be qualified enough to be the first. No, it was you. It was the systemic racism. You're the one. It was your fault, you know, that I'm the first. There are many, you know, and the fact that you relegated to black folks, black men and women, to these awful roles, step and fetch it, and all these things. And then finally, you know, you, and even Sidney said it, okay, but you're not, when are you going to put me into a love scene? You know, I could be the, you know, sort of this dignified black. And then, you know, and there were so many conflicting feelings when you saw Sidney. In fact, when I finally died, I went back and started looking at things like Lilies of the Field, where he won his first Academy Award, or became the first black person to win an Academy Award. And I'm looking at the role, you know, and again, a lot of it was, and sometimes as black folks, we have that problem. Our role is to make white folks feel comfortable. And that's a very hard job, man, that a lot of us have in our job today, managing white people, you know, making white people feel comfortable with us. That's a hard job, man. You know, not just doing your job, but also making sure white folks are comfortable. That seems to be the epitome of Sidney Poitier early on, was to make, you know, white folks feel comfortable, whether it's, you know, and I remember there came to be a point in his career when things got turned real militant that he had to really defend himself because he was really raked over the coals. In fact, somebody, a black critic at the New York Times wrote a piece that really devastated Poitier. He said, why do white folks love Sidney Poitier so much? And it's one of those stinging criticisms, which you want to dismiss, but it's one of those things that kind of, you wake up at night thinking about it. So, why do white folks like me so much? You know? But so those are just some of my thoughts about him. And
I think some of the early ones, you know, No Way Out, kind of the early ones are great to watch again to see the dignity. I'll tell you one that I saw as a kid and I rewatched recently, A Patch of Blue, where, you know, I guess they say it's the first time a black man kisses a white woman on screen. And I remember as a kid seeing, I didn't even know that, you know, I was so young, I didn't even know what that meant or what it was about. Although I think Ivan Dixon was in there too. And Ivan Dixon was trying to explain, you know, why it's so problematic to have this relationship. But there's just some great work. And then later on, you know, the Buck and the Preacher, Let's Do It Again, kind of all this kind of fun stuff where he's doing some directing and that kind of thing. He, you know, becomes a much more relaxed and humorous Sidney in a lot of kinds of ways. And, you know, again, think about co-starring with the once great Bill Cosby, which is a whole nother, that's another segment too, which we are not going to get to.
There's a great thing he did with Paul Newman called Paris Blues, which was a great, I mean, he was a jazz musician living in Paris. And he was playing the sax, and Paul Newman was a trombonist. And Diane Carroll was his love interest. You know, again, it's not Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but it's a thing called Paris Blues. Watch it.
Okay. And just to close this out, it's just an ironic comparison. Max Julian passed away recently too.
Yeah.
And you know, for those of you that aren't of a certain age, you know, Max Julian, you know, big moment on screen was the Mac. And the Mac was just the counter to everything that Sidney was about. I mean, it's a movie about pimps. And there's actually a great documentary talking, and Max Julian is in it, about, you know, pimps in Oakland. But Max had to do, I guess, and you think of that kind of work to get paid and eat and that sort of thing. But it really is kind of a great kind of two people to look at to see different paths that we're taking in these kinds of moments. But this is great. You know, if you don't know Max Julian, that's somebody to take a look at too. This is your entertainment a segment for your pandemic viewing.
which continues, by the way.
All right, Bill, let's close out with any big predictions on any of the stuff we talked about? You mentioned the Australian Open.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I predict that Djokovic will leave the Day's End and will play ultimately will play in the Australian Open. That I think the government will all huddle and they'll come up with a solution. 1 + 1 = millions. And Djokovic somehow miraculously will be able to play in the Australia. They may make him play with a mask. Maybe that'll be his penalty. But I predict that Djokovic will play and that AB will not.
Okay, Antonio Brown will not be playing. Oh, okay, this prediction may be more of a hope. You know, longtime Raider fan in some ways. That'd be a great fit for Brian Flores for a lot of reasons. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if that comes about. But again, there's a lot of elements in place, including the success the team's having now, and including, you know, whether or not Flores takes the money and sits out and that sort of thing. So that's it. The other bigger, not even prediction, it's just a concern. What's this hiring cycle going to look like for black men? is this year going to be different? I mean, we're thinking that we're already, as a spotlight, we're already in the negative column. I mean, we're down one. And there's so many great candidates. And intentionally, I do not use the word qualified. There's so many great candidates that are ready to go. And so I'm just concerned about what happens this time around. You know, there are, you know, owners that are on the diversity committee that have openings this time around. So they're people that really know the kinds of issues that are there. But that's something to keep a close eye on as we go forward. And, you know, Flores is in the mix. Somebody's got to hire him. But I think a lot of that's going to be his determination of whether or not he wants to be out there, unless it's something we don't know about.
Well, yeah, I hope it's not. Well, I won't even say that. Yeah, you're right. I just think that the question you're raising, and I guess my question to you is whether nepotism and the old boys network will outweigh diversity. And historically, that's what's happened, is that the old boys network has always outweighed diversity, where we're going to hire our guy, my friend, my boy, you know, my connection, my relationship. And African-Americans have always been outside of that. So the question is, will the old boys network triumph once again? And my prediction is that probably.
Yeah. And we're gonna spend some time on that nepotism issue sometime going forward. It is, you know, as we watch Kyle Shanahan, for example, I mean, he's kind of a prime example of, yeah, maybe it was a boy wonder, maybe it wasn't, but you can't, it's easier to be a boy wonder when your father's the head coach and he brings you in. And there's so much of that goes on that we haven't highlighted a lot. Now, I think it's something we should look to a little bit more as we go forward. Again, one of those advantages, this is, you know, really making, you know, a much, much deeper connection, but this is kind of a, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates kind of analysis of why Black people are in the condition they've been there in today. It's because you start off at such a tremendous disadvantage. You can't buy property. You can't, all these things you haven't been able to do to accumulate wealth. Well, we haven't had a presence in these leadership roles in the league, so we can't hand it off to our sons and hopefully daughters. Nothing to hand off.
Right. What does Ray Charles say? Them that's got is them that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet.
Well, I think we once again found a way to end on a optimistic note. uplift our podcast.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy New Year. Well, listen, I think we also have our producer, an optimistic note.
Yeah.
Our producer has a wonderful baby boy. That's great news. That's, you know, babies are always optimistic. You know, there's hope, you know, optimism and all that. So, Kendall, congratulations. And that's hope, right? I think that's optimism. That's hope.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
And so we better get off right now. Thanks, Bill. Take care.
This show is brought to you by Global Sport Matters. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen. Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. This episode was produced by me, Kendall Jones, Manager of Events and Programs, and big thanks to sound designer and editor Sam Esparza and Big U Music. Our Marketing and Communications Manager is Crisal Valencia. Our Digital Communications Specialist is Brendan Kleen. And our marketing and event assistants are Natalie Skegan, Aiden Corrales, and Kate Nelson. Stay up to date with the Global Sport Matters team by following us on Twitter. We're at Global Sport MTRS. And be sure to sign up for our newsletter by clicking on the envelope icon at globalsportmatters.com.